welcome to the Anxious Conservatives podcast. I'm Liam here, and I'm joined, as always, by my good friend and colleague, Monique Poirier. Hey, Monique, how's things?
Good. Quite sick today, but doing all right.
Not with COVID.
Not with COVID.
What are the symptoms?
I actually just think my allergies are really bad.
Have you booked your vaccines yet?
So I'm booked for Saturday, but I don't think I'll be going if I'm in my current state.
Well, you don't have COVID then, because you've booked your vaccine, so you have the immunity. So, but anyway, we need to keep moving on, because we actually are joined for the second time by a very special guest and good friend of the podcast, Mr. Christopher Penk, MP. Well, he's an MP, but of course, Parliament has been suspended under the tyrannical Ardern regime, and so he can't fulfil his functions as an MP. But he
That's
is
right. I was wondering what was coming after that. He's an MP, but
he's an MP, but he has no ability to scrutinise the government, because the government doesn't want to be scrutinised for the time being. But Chris, you are the National Party defence spokesman, is that right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. I have that great honour,
and a former, well, a veteran of two navies. So the you were an officer on what ship you were an officer on in the New Zealand Navy?
Oh, Te Kaha, HMNZS Te Kaha. It's one of the ANZAC class frigates. Yeah,
yep.
Yeah, one of the two. 50% of the fleet,
and a submariner in the Australian Navy for 4 years. Is that right?
Yeah, that's about right. Uh-huh.
And in between, you carried the handbag for the Governor General.
I believe aide-de-com is the expression you're after, but yes, it was a handbag carrying operation, if we can put it like that. Yeah,
you had to carry the handbag that had all the nuclear codes in it, you know, in case.
Yeah, that's right.
We'll break out.
That's right. Well, it was the pen that signed some acts and acts of Parliament as law, so sort of more constitutional law geek than military.
Oh, that's amazing.
Firepower involved.
Did you steal the pen when you
No. Truth be told, it was probably the ballpoint pen at the foyer of the hotel that we had something faxed to, and just, you know, with the sign here sticker on it, basically.
Wow. So it wasn't like a ceremonial pen with a big feather quill and, you know, and special ink and everything like that. It was just a Bic pen.
If you'd like it to be, then sure. That's exactly what happened, yeah. Corgis in attendance.
Well, I mean, we wanted to talk to you today, Chris. We always want to talk to you, but in particular because...
We always are talking to you.
Yeah, but in particular because, you know what, wait a minute. Before we get on to it, we have to make some mandatory awkward chit-chat about being in lockdown. So, so Monique, how are you surviving? How's lockdown going?
So since the other night, nothing much has changed. I went for my obligatory 30-minute walk yesterday, which I think made me more sick, and now here I am.
Yeah, doing lots of Zoom meetings and stuff, and, you know.
Yep.
Yep.
Yep. Cool. Lots going on.
How about you, Chris? I mean, I know the government won't let you do your job, but are you, you still finding things to do in lockdown?
Living the dream, as they say. All the more for not going to Parliament. It's amazing how much you can get done as an MP without actually going to that place. So, I mean, if you think about it as a sort of a recess week that wasn't supposed to be, you know, it's sort of, it's weirdly sort of business as usual, really. Yeah. Just, you know, not in that place. So constituent messages, I mean, all the sort of usual things about how bad the government is.
Have you been doing
select
committees?
Oh, I do one tomorrow. So I'm, well, or today, depending on when you listen to this, or yesterday for that matter. We can go on. Anyway.
And are you writing another book?
I'm not. No. I'm writing a series. Well, I suppose you could call it a book. I mean, you could probably more accurately describe it as a series of tweets. So in other words, no.
It's actually quite a good book. It's got quite a few, the flattening the country. You know, people obviously hated it at the time because it went against the prevailing message, but it had a lot of good dad jokes in it, I felt.
Well, thank you. I feel damned with faint praise, but I would say in my defence, number one, it remains as at, you know, today or yesterday or whenever you're listening to this again, the only sort of attempt at a comprehensive view of what happened. And I mean, I'm sort of tongue-in-cheek there because, you know, you know, it's written by me, and I'm not impartial and didn't pretend to be, but I do find it extraordinary that there's no sort of Royal Commission or other investigation. I suppose we've had the reports into the schmozzle that was PPE and contact tracing along the way, and then there was the, I don't know, Roe Simpson or whatever that thing was.
To do, that would be treasonous if there was, you know,
Like that. There'll have to be a big review at the end. It's the most expensive thing that's ever happened in New Zealand. So, you know, they'll get someone like some impartial person like Judith Tizard or someone to head up a Royal Commission to work out just how much Jacinda saved us and how awesome it was.
Well, maybe in the interest of balance, it should be one Judith from each side. So I propose Tizard and Collins, and, you know, lock them in a room together and see who prevails.
Have a lock-in. Okay, but because, you know, I mean, obviously we just always talk about COVID now, but actually on the other side of the world, apart from the pandemic, there's just this complete horrific thing that's happening in Afghanistan, a country where we had and now have again members of the armed services in harm's way for so long. And it's just a giant mess. And I was seeing today that the Taliban said to America and in Britain, no, 31st of August, you're out. Otherwise, there'll be repercussions.
Yeah.
I mean, Chris, how do we get to this point? I mean, we went over in 2001. We were there for two decades training up the Afghan army. What's happened?
Well, it's all turned to you know what, hasn't it? I suppose you could trace the origins back, I mean, as far in history as you want to go, and you could be cynical about the motivations for any US-led invasion of any Middle Eastern country. I remember the running joke at the time that they were naming Operation Iraqi Freedom was that initially it was going to be Operation Iraqi Liberation, but someone worked out the acronym was going to be unfortunate on that one. Yeah. So, you know, and it's one of those scenarios that, of course, everyone will impose their own worldview interpretation. Yeah. But I think a reasonably sane, balanced view was that, you know, post 9/11, something must be done. This was something. And so the climate was that it was, you know, a good idea, and you could justify it in all kinds of different ways in relation to, I was going to say, stamping out. You know, you end up using the same language as the COVID messaging, but, you know, to sort of try and crack down on these places where the Taliban and others who were feeding into Al-Qaeda were flourishing and, you know, planning the next attack on World Trade Center or, you know, whatever equivalent. So there was sort of justifications at the time, but I must admit I did wince the other day. I heard, and I should say this sort of quite, you know, as respectfully as I'm able, but I heard in New Zealand veteran actually of the Afghanistan conflict saying that the place was better than when we'd arrived some two decades earlier, because women, you know, who were girls in the school system in the meantime could now read and write, and they hadn't been allowed an education under the Taliban. And that's obviously hugely significant, and I don't want to minimize the importance of a good education, but it doesn't sound like a good enough reason to invade a sovereign country and end up with the amount of blood and treasure expended and you know,
because it's a pretty significant conflict even from New Zealand's perspective. I mean, we lost eight soldiers, it was you know, which is the greatest loss of all, but we must have spent hundreds of millions, and there were some serious battles. I mean, we Willie Appiah got a VC. I mean, that's it was a significant sort of long-term conflict for us, and it just does feel like it's all been wasted in some ways.
Well, I don't know, is waste the right word when for 20 years at least, you know, women weren't being murdered by the Taliban, you know, like is that total waste?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. So there are 20 years of freedom, which is you know, in the parts of the country that were controlled.
In parts, exactly.
But I mean, having said that, I mean, the world's biggest superpower went in to stop the Taliban from having control of the country so that terrorists couldn't use it as a jumping off base. And and what they've been defeated basically because they, you know, we're back to the status quo ante.
So what's the deal with Joe Biden? Because everything he seems to say is inconsistent with what other world leaders are saying, like the fact that apparently they all supported his decision when in fact they didn't. We know that they've come out and said it, and also he seems totally unaware of what actually seems to be happening over there. You know, like, well, on the ground.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's got a lot that he's unaware of,
to be fair.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, what do you think, Chris? I mean, was it worth? I mean, look, actually, you know what? That's actually a really big question. So, you know, I'm not sure if we can solve that in the podcast. You know, but
yeah, I guess the sunk cost fallacy is hard to sort of get around to say. Well, you know, we were there for so long, we invested so much that you know, we had to sort of keep going because it, you know, at some point that becomes an absurdity. But I'm actually quite taken with something that Monique just said along the lines of, you know, the fact that 20 years of freedom is not insignificant in itself. And I'm paraphrasing and not doing your argument justice, but I do suppose there's a parallel universe in which that hadn't happened and there was significantly more terrorist activity or carnage, because of course it's easy to say, you know, this, you know, you can sort of subtract the good bits or the bad bits as you wish and present a view of the world now with the benefit of hindsight. But of course we don't know what would have happened had that not been the case.
I mean, it's we can never know, and there's no method of ever knowing. Mm. But what we perhaps and also, I mean, the New Zealand, we did our part. We carried more than our burden, but we don't have control of everything, but we do have control of some things. And you know, it was frustrating at the time that our security partners were gearing up. They were, I mean, even if the fall of the Afghan government was precipitous, it seemed like our allies or our security partners were gearing up to try and get their people out and to be available and to get relief to those Afghans who had worked with them. And the New Zealand government was kind of asleep at the switch for at least a few days in a crisis in which days mattered. I mean, is that your view too, Chris?
Oh, mine is, yeah, very much so. Yeah, I mean, I'm just sort of still trying to process the fact that an announcement you make in February about a withdrawal in May doesn't lead you to ask yourself the question, is there anything that could possibly go wrong once everyone else has left the party and switched off the lights? And it just seems extraordinary to me that while you couldn't necessarily have predicted the speed at which the Taliban would have taken back over or even the fact of it, the possibility that existed surely would have led to some sort of contingency planning. And I think the fact that the US, the UK, well, basically all of Five Eyes minus, you know, the blink, the Four Eyes and the blink that of course New Zealand's infamously described as being probably quite fairly at times, you know, they managed to scramble a bit more quickly. So I don't know if it's the fact that they, you know, had enough urgency about the matter to meet on the Thursday or the Friday even. And our guys said, oh, well, you know, of course it's the weekend. And we know the Taliban don't work weekends. and just sort of mucked around for a couple of days. And, you know, 48 hours is a long time. And I presume in that kind of environment. So yeah, I just can't understand sort of on a quite a sort of a medium to long term view, but also the short term, how the extent to which we were asleep at the wheel.
Yeah,
it's no secret that I don't like much of what this government has done over its time. However, my response, my feelings towards this, I've never felt anything like this about our government. I felt sick over that weekend. The lack of urgency. It genuinely made me feel quite ill.
Yeah.
And I know it did a lot of other people as well. They just didn't understand it.
So there were around two dozen at the most New Zealanders registered as being in Afghanistan at the time. And then the next question is, are those people who were employed by the NZDF or who worked with the NZDF and whose life was at risk, I guess working with us on the assurance that the international community was going to be there for the long term and to carry any burden, and then So how many are you briefed on this, Chris? How many people? How are we talking, like the Afghan interpreters and contractors? How many people are we talking about, more or less?
Well, it's hard to know exactly how many, partly because brackets the opposition, are not being briefed on it. And I genuinely don't know if that's to be expected or not. I find it sort of surprising and slightly frustrating that, you know, we're relying on the media rather for our updates. But, that's right. We don't have any greater right than that. But you do feel the responsibility when you're contacted by these people and, who are desperate for their family members over there. And you can make what seem pretty compelling cases of eligibility to be rescued for exactly the reasons you've said in terms of having helped out New Zealand. You know, these are not just guys we knew because we were on holiday and we bumped into them and had a bit of rapport. I mean, these are in danger specifically because they had helped us. So I don't know what the number is. And partly it depends as well, because you could draw the line in a place that says those who are sort of officially employed and, you know, maybe had a little silver fern, you know, on a badge somewhere, or they could have been sort of contractors or sort of, you know, brought on the meals once upon a time. But we don't know. Just so much is in the dark about it. It's really frustrating. And we don't even know, actually, and this is probably a pretty serious point, I believe, we don't even know how it's going in terms of how many of these people are likely to be we won't even know after the fact necessarily how it's gone.
Exactly.
Yeah. So there's a plane headed over there now. Has it arrived yet in Afghanistan? Or
Yeah, it's been there and actually come back and it's on its way again.
Right. Okay. Mm. Yeah. Shows how informed I am to ask that question. Okay. So it's been there. It's lifted or rescued some people and it's on its way back. Where's it headed to?
It's brought New Zealanders back, right? Not, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. It all went straight into quarantine.
Right. Okay. I mean, it's just sometimes you just read about, remember how the Gurkhas were really badly treated by the British government?
Yeah.
They've denied pensions and things. And it just, you'd think that you can make a special case for the limited amount of people who went out of their way to put their lives at risk. And, you know, we have a refugee quota every year that we should be trying to meet. Obviously, with the borders being closed, I don't think we've ever come close to it, especially not the expanded quota we've got in the moment. You'd think that if there's any slam dunk case of bending over backwards, you know, subject to a few security checks, perhaps, that this would be the one. And yet it was Chris Farfoy again.
I love that you sound surprised.
Yeah. Chris Farfoy, of all people, Chris, like the most competent, capable minister of this government, Chris Farfoy, like just issued that callous statement we're not looking to extend the program.
Yeah.
And then I think, was it the Prime Minister on Morning Report saying, well, you know, we have to follow, you know, it's actually the fault of the national government because in 2012 they passed this program and only included these people as if they hadn't been in government.
Sometimes Jacinda forgets that she is a majority government. I think sometimes she just forgets.
You can do whatever you want.
Yes. Yeah.
Believable, eh? I just got the feeling it was all just too hard. It was sort of an amoral decision. It wasn't the immorality of saying, oh, well, look, we don't feel like we should help. It's like they couldn't be bothered to turn their mind to it. And the height of the confusion or lack of attention to the most basic detail, I think, was actually when Farfoy was asked about it again and sort of conceded, oh, well, maybe we better have another look.
Right.
Penny Hinnerey, the defence minister, was asked about it and he didn't know that had happened.
Yep.
So, I mean, the left hand's not talking to the right in a way that just, it might be, you know, poor systems, but I just think it's a lack of care about it. And I just, I genuinely can't get over it. And it's tempting to sort of, you know, make an easy throwaway comment about, you know, government of kindness, but I genuinely can't reconcile it with anything that any decent government made up of human beings that sort of, you know, have met other human beings would come to. So,
yeah,
I mean, there's all
I'm with Monique on this.
There are always going to be, I suppose, people who sort of gainsay a bit, say, oh, well, if you think that's bad, how bad would National have been? But it's impossible for us to be lagging or to be dropping the ball so much behind Australia. There's just no way that you could imagine John Key or Bill English wouldn't be doing as much as Australia is doing. And yet, like vaccines, we're just so far behind again.
Yeah. Well, I mean, did you know that if National was in government for COVID last year, everyone would have died, apparently?
Yeah, I know.
The strategy National would have taken. Everyone would have died.
Well, of course, the first thing we would have done is told Ashley Bloomfield to get stuffed and not bother taking any kind of public health advice.
No, hang on. But this, it just, that confuses me a little bit, because I believe that Simon Bridges was generally a few days ahead of calling for the government.
And was at least anticipating
what the government was going to be doing and getting out ahead of it, at least by a couple of days on most things.
Yeah.
Well, funny you should say that. I was looking in a very good book on the subject the other day. And there we go. It's a plug.
Is it available?
Available at all good booksellers.
It's not about that. And this is the conspiracy. You see, they've caused the lockdown specifically to avoid bookstores being able to sell my book. This is how deep it's going.
Yeah.
But actually,
your book in Simon's.
Well, that's the segue, actually. I might have been having this conversation with a certain former leader of the National Party, which was meant to sound very specific, but actually I've got to qualify that. Could have been anyone or a number of people. But anyway, no. So, dear old Simon was talking about the fact that we had, we had been ahead of the curve. I shouldn't use these kind of phrases that now have a particular meaning. But it was the 26th of January. Anyway, that's what I was getting to. I had a look in, said book, and it was the 26th of January that and Michael Woodhouse put out a statement saying this thing needed to be taken seriously. And they were fully a month later, scaremongering, I think, for a little while. It was scaremongering and it was racism because, of course, heaven forbid that we could talk about a virus that seemed to be originating from China without any kind of implications for the property market or wherever the other side tend to go to and such names.
I believe the line at the time was, Simon Bridges is doing a Donald Trump with his, travel ban. And Seymour, and even though my relationship with Seymour is complicated, in fairness, he also was calling to close down flights very early on and was accused of being, what else? Get this, guys. Just get this. They said he was being racist when he... Could you guess that was what it was going to be? When he called for it. The party of Chinese sounding names. Anyway.
Unbelievable.
There's not much point in litigating all that, but have you been fully vaxxed as an MP?
My number came up the other day. I turned 40. I turned 40 a couple of years ago actually, but the 40-year-old cohort came up the other day. But I do have immunity because I've booked. So
that's right. That's the main measure.
If you'd asked me if I'd engage with the system, the answer would be yes.
Yeah, that's right.
So no, I haven't in fact received the shots, and I mean, I don't think I could have played any kind of "don't you know who I am" card. And funnily enough, the phone call never came. But there probably was an opportunity somewhere along the way if you'd worked hard enough at understanding which places just before closing time would offer jabs to people walking past on the street. You could have sort of done a few laps, I guess. But I don't want to get ahead of when I should have been. I don't want to be behind. I just wanted to, be a 40-something year old whose number would eventually come up. So here we are.
Because I were asthma, so I was in fairly early, and I was meant to get my second jab on the, I think the 18th or the 19th, but it was part of that 48-hour pause. So now I'm going to wait till like the 25th of September to get my second one. It just drives me nuts. I suppose if that annoys me, but how many other people, there's no way we're going to make the end of the year, is there?
Well, I mean, I know people who have just booked today and their appointments at the end of October, their first appointment.
There's no way.
And that's people booking, it hasn't even opened up to everyone yet.
Yeah.
And especially if we're going to shift the goalposts age-wise, then, what are we talking about a percentage of? What's the 70 or 80% out of? Is it all those who have been offered or all those above the age of, whatever that movable feast is? Goodness knows, there'll be plenty to argue about in terms of, that finer detail about what targets have or haven't been met. But the long and short of it is, of course, that it's been completely lackluster. And
but it's going to plan.
I don't know. I mean, look, Chris Bishop, he's just got a lot to answer for. You know, he just really does.
Yes. Well, as was discussed by you guys as recently as a couple of nights ago, if people were taking a bit more personal, they call themselves the Personal Responsibility Party National, they're not out actually actively, injecting themselves. So,
Chris Bishop just disgusts me in the way that he's over run riot in the Delta outbreak.
Yeah, you didn't know, you'd think sometimes he wasn't even the minister, he just doesn't take responsibility. Hopeless. He might as well be in opposition, all the good he's doing,
So how long do you think this lockdown's going to go for, Chris?
Oh, gosh.
How long do you think Labor wants to keep the House out of session?
Ah, well, that's the question, isn't it? I think actually, if I were going to be really cynical, I'd say it's actually got nothing to do with Parliament. I'd say it's got everything to do with the focus groups. I'm a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but I'm also, I genuinely think that it would be a smart move, not only politically, but actually in terms of the population's response, not to overplay the hand in terms of lockdowns. Because if you look across the ditch, I mean, Australians are a slightly different breed from us, but I don't think you'd have too much imagination necessary to say at some point it becomes counterproductive to lock down too hard because people will flout it. People will resent it. So I think at the risk of giving you some kind of ridiculous, how long's a piece of string kind of answer, I think it'll depend really how things are playing out in the mind of the public as much as in their, upper arms or where everyone gets vaccinated.
I mean, it was going around yesterday, I think, on Twitter, the spin-off did a poll or whatever, and 70-odd% agree with the level 4 lockdown. I don't think many people disagree with the action that was taken, but people are frustrated just about the entire thing, the slow rollout, the fact that they just seem totally unprepared for Delta. I do think that public sentiment, that support is slowly declining. That was once there in 2020.
Well, they might not credit, people will support the lockdown, and I've got to admit, as a hypochondriac, I completely see the need for it. Like, I'd rather overreact, but it doesn't mean that they are happy with the reasons for why it's had to happen, there is a difference between those things. And, I think you're right, Chris, as Aristotle said, man is a gregarious beast. It's not natural for us to be like cooped up like this. I hate having to spend all the time.
I'm starting to get some back problems from like sitting really badly at home, like on the couch.
And as you've seen overseas, there's not unlimited goodwill for it. At some point, the discipline will break. And so, this is what frustrates me is that we did all that hard work last year. But we know that part, not the whole solution, but a big part of the solution is got to be to get their vaccination rate up.
Yeah.
The 70-80 to 90% or whatever it is. But
they won't give us a figure though. They don't have any goal.
Yeah.
And I know that goals shift and targets shift and stuff, but there's just nothing there.
Yeah. I mean, look, the thing is, whatever it is, it's meant to be much more than it is now. Mm-hmm. And the fact that, we're actually ahead of schedule. It just drives me nuts. Mm. And I think that is a narrative that people are seeing through and people are
sick of it. They are. They are.
I mean, there was even a piece on RNZ today.
Yes.
I know, like saying that the government's reason didn't all stack up, And what about your constituents? What about your constituents, Chris?
Oh yeah, I'm picking up a lot different sentiment this time around, to be honest. And just by way of small example, last time around, I got absolutely slammed on Facebook, which is not as feral as, for example, Twitter, for saying it was ridiculous that butchers, greengrocers and bakers couldn't open at level 4, provided that they could meet essentially the same public health-based rules for doing that. You're contactless, you're one in, one out, and wearing masks and distancing and so on, a la the dairies. And I got absolutely slammed for that. And it was, I'll be honest and say, I didn't sort of see it coming. It was like a very minor version of what had happened to Simon Bridges infamously after he criticised the extension, I think it was, of a lockdown. And I made the equivalent post on Twitter the other day, which was, it was slightly sort of, it was better worded, I suppose, because it was a bit sardonic around the fact that supermarkets were running out of meat. And I said, well, if only there was, you know, essentially if only butchers could be allowed to offer the same thing. So exactly the same thing, but 18 months apart and, you know, all that water under the bridge. And it was very, you know, it was much better received, suffice to say. So here's a little barometer, you know, it's not scientific, it's not empirical, but it's sort of a little bit of an indication that the mood has definitely shifted. And for the reason I think that you said, Liam, which is that the lockdown may be necessary, but the reason that it's become necessary is relevant to people.
Yeah.
And the number of other things that are affected are piling up. Yeah. And it's not just health versus wealth, it's other health. It's the rare medications, funding that's not going to come through PharmAC because the revenue of the government is destroyed by a couple of weeks of extra lockdown than we'd otherwise would have needed. So it's all those things, and they do add up because everyone's got a little situation. They go, this is going to cost me in some other way.
I can't stand Twitter at the moment. I know we shouldn't talk about it because like it's lame to talk about, but I do think there has been like something's changed, right? Like with the government coming under a bit of pressure and all the stuff that we warned about, you know, all the warnings that we said, look, we're sitting ducks with this low vaccination rate, all of it sort of coming to fruition a little bit. And that Twitter's just gone so feral as a result. I mean, you know, like maybe if you're not on the center right and you're not absolutely copying it, but they've gone nuts. Chris, because you use Twitter very judiciously and you mostly do most of your dad jokes. You're very sort of Dean Nimbley-esque in your Twitter use. Whereas I should expect more flack because I seek it.
Chipster.
Yeah, but it's just really bad, don't you reckon, Monique, at the moment?
Yeah, it's also amazing to see them go after journalists as well that they wouldn't normally go after just for pointing out a simple thing like the Prime Minister's preamble is too long. You know, if the journalists are saying it, that generally means more people are as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I might have to go to Facebook. Do you use Facebook, Monique? I've never used it in years and years.
Not really.
Yeah. What do people use Facebook
for? I think
for?
Only, isn't it like only 60-year-olds, over 60-year-olds and anti-vaxxers?
Dads. It's like a real thing for mums and dads to use. Or maybe I'll change to LinkedIn.
No, just stay on Twitter. It's much more entertaining when you're there.
No, yeah, I know, but like, it's such a, you know, like I can't help it. There's so many dumb people on it, and I can't help. I'd like, you know,
but then but it's a team effort. We've got to take them down one at a time.
Yeah, but you can't. It's like, listen, it's just like getting. It's a quagmire, right? It's just like getting stuck in Iraq. Once you're in, you can't stop fighting.
There's it's quicksand more you move, the deeper you get. You know, it's the hole that you try and dig out of.
What's the exit strategy, you know, like for engaging with these people?
I tend to not reply to anyone in my comments unless I know them anymore. Yeah. So that I've been able to avoid a lot of yucky stuff. I tweet something and then, only engage with people I know.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Oh, look, we're actually running out of time. That's gone so fast because Chris is such a great guest. Don't you think?
We have to come on more often.
Well, we have to podcast more often for that to be true. Instead of twice every 6 months.
The podcast is a bit like your Twitter account, Liam. You're sort of all there or not at all. You're sort of, described it actually as trying to drink champagne out of a fire hose. It's just sort of all. I've enjoyed the experience on this occasion as always, so thank you for having me, and keep up the work, guys. You actually have a lot of value in the spectrum, an otherwise empty corner of
the political spectrum, right?
Yes,
absolutely.
Okay, good.
Exactly.
All right, well thank you very much for listening once again. This was the Anxious Conservatives podcast. That was Chris Pink, MP for now, Monique Poirier, and me, Liam, here saying goodbye.
Good night.